Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 163, featuring Vlado, who's been on several times, Lon, right?
Oh, yeah. It's always good to connect with Vlado and see what's on his mind.
Yeah, yeah. So we recorded this when you and I were in Sofia not long ago, back in January.
Chilly Sofia.
Oh, yeah. It was nice. It was a really good trip to do that and to be able to catch up with people. And Vlado was on for, we didn't have a huge amount of time because we were both very busy. So it's a little bit of a shorter podcast, but still a really good one. The main focus that we wanted to talk about was V-Ray Next, right?
Yep.
And V-Ray Next Beta 2?
Just dropped.
So you guys should be able to have that. And a lot of the things that we discuss in this podcast are available. For those of you who sort of casually listen to this podcast about all kinds of stuff, this is a heavy, heavy technical podcast, really in-depth about V-Ray and how it's progressed over the years and some of the new features that are available. We've written blog posts about a bunch of them.
Yeah, your new hair shader post is up now.
Is up. Yeah, I just put that one up so you guys can check out what the hair shader is. But also we have, you talk about some stuff that we haven't written about that much yet, like the new frame buffer, right?
Yeah. Some stuff that's coming up pretty soon.
And, the other thing that was discussed is V-Ray Cloud, which is kind of a big deal, kind of a new thing that we've put out there. It's our own, cloud service. And Vlado discusses it for a bit, but I also want to give you guys a heads up that we're going to have a much more in-depth podcast about cloud with my good friend Boris.
Right? Boom.
Boom. So be on the lookout for that. I just want to mention that, you know, Vlado is just an amazing person. Every time I talk to him, he just impresses me about how incredible and kind and smart and level-headed he is, you know. I really, really kind of think he's an amazing person. Want to do a couple of announcements besides the fact that we just talked about V-Ray Beta 2. Total Chaos, right?
Total Chaos.
Total Chaos, May
18th and 19th.
18th and 19th.
In Sofia Tech Park.
In Sofia. I actually...
Good time to visit Sofia.
Yep.
Not January.
Not January.
May is good.
May is going to be beautiful there.
Springtime.
And just before summer, so it'll be kind of nice. I just got a message from my good friend Mahmoud, who I did a podcast with at THU. And you remember Mahmoud, right?
Yeah,
from D2. He said, he's like, yeah, I think I'm going to come to Total Chaos. It sounds like fun. So... please come along. And if you want more information about it or how to register for it, just go to our website, chaoscoop.com, and go to the events page, and it should be right there, right?
Right, yep.
And then Vertex is happening. That's another thing I want to talk. That's before Total Chaos. I will be attending a conference in London called Vertex, which is really cool, and I'll be one of the keynote speakers there, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, held by our friends at 3D World, 3D Artists.
Yeah.
Should be really good, and I've seen the inner workings of your Digital Humans talk. I know that it's good, and you know, a little controversial, which is exciting.
Yeah, these days, especially with all the AI and deep learning stuff, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening even since I started these talks on Digital Humans, like the deep fake stuff. It's pretty scary.
Yep.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. I think I'm going to try to really ramp it up this time, really freak people out. But that'll be exciting. So, but I haven't. When was the last time you were in London?
It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's been a little while.
I think I was a kid last time I was in London.
Oh, really? That long?
Yeah. I mean, I've been to the airport, right? Because sometimes you have to transfer there. But like actually being walking around in London's been, they still speak English there, right?
Yeah. I got to spend about 3 weeks there a few years ago.
Yeah.
I stayed in Notting Hill, which I thought was, you know.
Oh, sweet.
The set of like a Hugh Grant film. And of course, all my meetings were in Soho. So, you know, I had a little bit of commute. But
right.
I felt like I was so proud because I'd ride the red double-decker bus.
Nice.
As like my commute. And I'm like, I'm doing it. I'm a Londoner.
Yeah. Weren't you tempted to buy like a really expensive umbrella while you were there?
Oh my God. Yes. So And I can't even, you know, this is how people aren't rational when they make purchasing decisions. There's a famous umbrella company there. I forget the exact name of it, Johnson & Sons or something.
Right.
And give you like bespoke umbrellas that are sized and fitted to you.
It's like a tailored umbrella.
It's like a tailored umbrella. And they've been around for centuries, and I just had to go see the, you know, the shop, and it's all gorgeous and everything. And of course the umbrellas are like 3.5 feet long with like wooden handles that are carved and everything. And, but they didn't have, you know, like they didn't have one that I could just go up and buy, you know, at the time. And then I was telling you, I'm like, I live in Southern California where it rains never. What the hell am I going to do with a $300 umbrella? You know, but in my mind, it was some kind of, you know, item that I would.
You need it.
I need it, or I would like give to my kids.
Right.
And they would be an heirloom. Well.
Well, it's good. Well, maybe I should check out the umbrella store. Probably will not buy one.
I did get a really great handmade pair of shoes, though.
Oh, yeah.
Which I had use for because it was right before my wedding. So.
Oh, yeah. I've seen those shoes. They're beautiful. Beautiful. All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. Hopefully, you'll appreciate this great podcast with Vlado and learn a lot about V-Ray Next. And please leave us your comments and your questions. We'd love to hear from you and let us know what you think. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I'm in Bulgaria. It's January. It's cold in Bulgaria in January, Vlado.
Yep.
You didn't warn me about this. Yeah, but it's nice. I haven't, you know, being living in LA, we don't see much snow, so it's nice to have a little snow. But there's lots of reasons we're here, and obviously learning a lot about what's going to happen. One of the big things that you've been working on for the last few months and probably still very heavily for the next several months is V-Ray Next, right?
Yep.
So let's explain what V-Ray Next actually is so that it's clear to everyone.
So V-Ray Next is the next version of V-Ray.
Yeah.
So V-Ray 3 has been out for a number of years now. Almost 4 years, yeah.
Because I think that when I started at Chaos Group, it was coming out. So that's how long it's been.
It's been a long time. And it's been a long journey. We've had 6 dot releases, and they were really big releases.
Mm-hmm.
V-Ray 3 changed a lot. We added the variance-based sampling. We added the automatic subdivision calculations.
Yeah.
We added the adaptive lights, among many other improvements, CryptoMats.
Right.
Every service pack has had 1 or 2 major new additions to V-Ray.
Yeah, I mean, they could almost be their own releases.
For other products, they may have been just full releases.
Mm-hmm.
But it's time for, you know, when you work on something for a long time, it gathers a little bit of, like, you know, the code starts growing hairs here and there, and it becomes a little bit untidy. So we had to step back for a second and try to clean things up. And we decided that the next major version of V-Ray will be the perfect opportunity for this. So basically, and I was really looking forward to this because it's the time between major releases and is the time where we can play with stuff and not worry about backward compatibility or breaking the V-Ray SDK.
Right.
So it's been so we had this huge list spreadsheet of things that we want to try.
Yeah.
Some of them were just things that we had to do, like we knew that we had to optimize V-Ray, make it faster and use more modern instructions. Basically, when we started writing V-Ray like more than 15 years ago, there were no SEC instructions.
Right.
And the code was not optimal in a lot of places, so we had to go and fix that, which was a lot of work, by the way.
Yeah.
But then we also had to rework code that has been there for a long time, and we've just added bits and pieces to it, but it had to be rewritten from scratch to be faster and more efficient. We've done that. An example is the V-Ray HDRI texture, which now is faster than it was before. Okay. Because of this, it will get even faster when we're fully done with everything. So optimization was one thing, but then we also played with stuff like Embry. We've been using Embry for the whole V-Ray 3 cycle. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was just for some parts of V-Ray, but then throughout the whole 3 dot releases, we've added more and more bits of V-Ray that were optimized by Embry.
And Embry, just to be clear, it's the code that's built into the Intel chips, right?
Embry is a ray tracing library from Intel that's very well optimized for Intel CPUs.
Okay. Does it work on AMD CPUs too?
It does work on AMD very well.
Okay.
And it's a lot faster than our original ray intersection code that we had in V-Ray. So we've been using it for more and more things like hair and motion blur.
Uh-huh.
And this is a process that happened gradually throughout the whole V-Ray 3 cycle. But anyway, they have a feature where you can intersect not triangles, but quadrangles.
Okay.
And it's supposed to be more efficient and everything, so we thought we should try it out. So that was a nice experiment that we did. We will not be using it eventually because it turned out to be a bit slower than we would have liked.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something that we had to try out. Also, because of the whole buzz about deep learning and neural networks, we wanted to see if there's anything there that we can use in V-Ray. So we did some experiments with that. They were not necessarily successful, but they gave us experience in this area and gave us ideas for other things that we can try.
Right.
We've also played a little bit with, V-Ray GPU also has been very steadily improving from the initial V-Ray 3 release throughout the whole.
Yep. Every dot release has got a major one or two or five new features for GPU.
And V-Ray 4 or V-Ray Next is obviously going to have even more GPU features. We're actually spent some time to basically re-architect the whole GPU code. Internally, we call it kernel 2.
Okay.
And we expect quite a bit of speed improvements from this new architecture. But we also experimented with stuff like optics, and optics is a library from NVIDIA for ray tracing on GPUs. So we wanted to see whether it's something that we can use. We're not using it right now, but again, it was something that we had to try out and see how it works. And it gave us ideas for other things that we can do on a GPU.
Right. But we did do some experimentation with optics because I wrote a blog post about it.
Not with the ray tracing part, but the denoiser, we are definitely going to use that.
Yeah.
And we will be adding it to V-Ray 4.
Which is next. We should explain why it's called
Next. So why is V-Ray Next? Because when you start saying V-Ray 4 for 3ds Max.
Yeah, 4 3ds Max.
It becomes very, it doesn't roll off the tongue easily. So we decided we should just call it V-Ray Next and be done with it.
Right.
And it's also, to be honest, quite it's the biggest change in V-Ray that's happened in a really long time where we've tried to weed out code that's been there for years and make it faster and cleaner. So it's really something next.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I remember when we were first looking at the very early betas and you were warning everyone, it's like, everything's going to break. we're going to really break this.
It will break, yes.
Yeah.
But there was no way. If we wanted to move forward, we had to just get rid of some stuff.
Right. Now, this happened before on 2, maybe? There was a big rewrite as well?
There was no major change.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing as big as we did for V-Ray Next.
Okay.
So also, because with V-Ray 3, one of the last features that we had in V-Ray 3.5 was the adaptive lights.
Yes.
And that kind of got us thinking into this direction. And we realized that we can use a similar approach to do a better dome light. So, and this is one of the features that
right
is coming out in very next as well.
But dome lights are okay. So dome lights are very, very important, as we know. We wrote a blog yep. post about it. And we'll put it up there. But the main benefit that people will get out of it is for interior scenes.
Yes.
So it'll be fast even with complete, you know, like exterior scenes, but interior yep. scenes where you have the dome light coming in. So therefore the HDR has to go through the windows, right? Yep. So, or the skylight or the door or whatever you happen to have open to the outside. But the traditional way of solving that problem to, in order to get it better was to do these skylight portals.
Yes. And
now it wasn't, the skylight portals were not originally designed to do that, right?
No, they were done so many years ago because so there was this ray tracing competition where people were given a scene and they had to render it. Uh-huh. One of them was the Sibenik Cathedral scene, which uh-huh. had all these, the entire scene was lit by these small windows.
Right.
On the sides, and it was really difficult to get light inside. So that's why I did the light portals. And they worked, but we didn't have the dome light then. We the dome light was added after the portals, and we never did V-Ray in a way that allows them to work well together.
Okay, so it used to be done with like an environment light, right?
Yeah.
And you'd have to use GI to get it in there.
Yeah. And then I realized that we could fix the portals to work with HDR lighting. We kind of did some experiments in that regard, but then I thought like, this is stupid. We should get rid of the portals like altogether.
Right.
So nobody wants to go around their scene and then place lights manually at every window.
Right. Yeah. And then they may not get them the right place, position yeah, correctly. And
it's just more work. Right. And I thought that we should be able to use the same approach that we did for the adaptive lights. Basically, V-Ray should be able to figure out where the environment lighting is coming from and adapt to that. And that also got us to think about other things that we can use the light cache for. Because we've had it for so many years in V-Ray, but it's only been used just to accelerate GI. Mm-hmm. But during this initial pre-pass of the scene, we can actually get a lot more information. And we're not using it. So it made sense to see if there's... we can use it for things like... except for the adaptive lights, we also now use it for automatic white balance and exposure, mm-hmm. which I think is like, for me, it's been it's very simple, but it's so useful because it just takes away so much fiddling with the camera.
Yeah.
ISO
yeah.
settings and everything, but I just leave it on all the time nowadays.
Well, I try to explain it in my blog post about the automatic camera. I said, you know, sure, there's some photographers out there that like to go in manual mode, but they have a guess as to what the lighting is pretty easily because of intense years of training.
Yep.
But they also go into, you know, an aperture priority mode or some yeah. kind of thing yep. to make sure the exposure is correct.
Yeah. So that was I'm personally, I find it very helpful for myself. Mm-hmm.
And the other one is also obviously the automatic white balance, which is also nice because yep. if you have an HDR that's too green or something like that, yep. then everything looks green. So it's nice.
Yep. And the whole V-Ray Next idea is that we will try to make V-Ray basically smarter mm-hmm. using the light cache is one thing that we can do, but also there are other... areas that we can improve. The Corona guys did some research on direct lighting as well. So they have their own version of adaptive lights, but it's done in a different way.
Okay.
And it was interesting for us to compare the two approaches and see which one works better.
Well, let's talk about this because I think the last time we were probably on, I think, was with you and Andre, right? Andra.
Yep.
Andra?
Andra.
Andra. And so how's it gone? How's the partnership gone since it's a little bit more public now, obviously?
So far, so good.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a lot of stuff to figure out how we can fit together.
Yeah.
And I think just looking at the code of both render engines, people seem to be under the impression that you can just take whole pieces of code from one render and pop it into the other, and voila, you got something faster or better. But it's not
like
the case.
Taking the engine out of a Toyota and putting it into a BMW. It doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. Obviously, we can compare approaches, and some things are probably easier to move.
Right.
But and also the philosophy of the two renderers is a little different.
And what do you mean by that?
It's just the rendering happens in a slightly different way. And it's not immediately like you can't take the whole code and put it into the other engine and expect it to work.
Right.
I did an experiment where I took the adaptive lights from VRA and I put them in Corona just to test.
Right.
And that worked. But not everything is... It required quite a lot of... additional coding to get things to match completely.
So what about the? There's been some question about the adaptive dome light, for example. Like you said, you didn't just take because they have some form of adaptive dome light, right?
Yeah, but their approach is different from ours in many ways.
Right.
And the adaptive dome light is basically something completely different. So we looked at what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Just to see if it can help us. But at the end, we decided that it's just going to be too difficult to do the same thing in V-Ray.
Right.
So the adaptive dome light that we eventually came up with is completely different than what they have in Corona.
Right. Okay. So you have we have our own thing. Now, obviously, you mentioned the light cache has become a really important prepass because it basically can gather enormous amount of information in basically a few seconds.
Yep.
And by doing that, obviously V-Ray has gotten a lot smarter about things. It's like it optimizes for adaptive lights, adaptive dome lights, for the exposures. And so is this something that you feel that most users, and if they're going to get the best out of V-Ray, they should probably just have it on all the time, right?
That seems to be the case for the moment.
Right.
And it will get even better. We plan to use... So one of the features that we want to explore is to use the light cache to help us find the optimal bucket sizes for the different parts of the scene.
Oh, really? This is new. See, I learn things every time.
Yeah. It's an idea. We haven't tested it. It might not work, even though I think it should.
Right.
But it's... It's also something we can use the light cache for. Right now, there's always the last stuck bucket problem. And we thought about the different ways to solve it. And there are different approaches. We'll try a few of them. But using the light cache was one idea.
Yeah, well, I worked on many a car commercial in my time. And whenever I would have a car commercial, I'd have the entire car rendered and then two buckets stuck, one on each headlight.
Headlights. Yes.
And so that's been that would be pretty cool. So basically the light cache would look at it, it's like, okay, let's start with these headlights, making as many small little buckets as possible and then do the rest.
Yep, I see you.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's really smart. So how does the light cache know that this is going to take a long time to render this because it's really bright or
can measure the time that it takes to trace rays from the camera throughout the scene for different parts of the scene.
How
it can work.
That's pretty smart. This seems to be a really interesting theme about the smartness of or the intelligence of the data. Now, does that mean that the light cache itself gets bigger, or is it just it's the same light cache you've had for a while?
No, it's the same light cache. We haven't. Obviously, it's used to fill other structures in the end, like the adaptive dome light grid.
Right.
But it's not, the light cache itself isn't changing all that much.
Yeah. But what's interesting is the, I want to talk about the denoiser for a second and about the optics denoiser. Tell me a little bit about that denoiser as opposed, because we had our own denoiser as well, right?
Yep.
So what's different about the optics denoiser?
So the optics denoiser took us a little bit by surprise. Obviously NVIDIA showed it at GTC last year.
Yes.
And it looked interesting. I got a chance to see how it looks from close up. We didn't know that NVIDIA will just give it away.
No, but we should, okay, before we, yes, you're right. We didn't know that. But what was interesting about it was mainly how fast it was, right?
Yeah, because it's based on the way it's built. Just the neural network is very, very fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically just guesses the correct result, whereas the V-Ray denoiser has to calculate the result.
Right.
The NVIDIA denoiser just tries to guess that.
Yeah, the way I try to analyze it is that it's a calculation you have to do, right? So the difference would be, you know, like if you're going to use an idea, is that it has learned a lot about how to denoise something already. So it's got all that information yep. learned. And so it'd be, the difference would be like me saying, okay, what is 5 plus 5? The computer goes, counts all my fingers to get to 10, but I already know that 5 plus 5 yep. is equals 10. So I can yep. just say 10, right? Yep. So that's how much faster it is.
Yeah, basically that's what it does.
Yeah. And so, it does it very fast. Now, what's the advantage of it being so fast?
Well, the obvious advantage is that you can basically just keep it on all the time and see like a denoised version of the image.
Right. So when you're doing progressive rendering, it's just constantly denoised.
Yeah, if you do interactive progressive rendering, you can always see a denoised result.
Right.
And it's really good when you have only a few samples in the image during the initial stages, because it just fills the missing information with something that it guesses would be close to the final result. And it's actually really good at this.
Yeah, it is. But one of the things that helps it that's important to know is you have to give it some render elements.
Yeah, you have to give it the diffuse surface color. It's an albedo.
Mm-hmm.
And also if you have normals, it also helps to preserve details.
Right, like edges and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, because I've noticed if you don't have any of that, it's not necessarily as good.
It still does.
It does noise, but it's yeah. may miss edges yeah. and may does a yeah. bunch it of texture helps. Problems. Yeah. yeah. So it is a pretty cool thing. So it is now going to be your, because when we first wrote a blog post about this, it was sort of like an experiment. We were trying it out. But now you think it's good enough that we could probably include it in V-Ray
yeah,
next,
the,
right?
The plan is to add it to Beta 2.
Oh, okay.
Next, it's already in the nightly build. It's not exposed in the UI, so you can't actually
turn it on.
But it will do that for Beta 2.
Now, is this going to replace our denoiser, or is it going to be two different denoisers?
It's not a direct replacement yet. Our denoiser still has a few advantages. We worked on the ability to denoise multiple render elements.
Yeah.
And here the key thing is that we're just not denoising each element by itself.
Right.
To remove the noise from it, but we're denoising all elements at the same time to make sure that they compose properly to the right, to the beauty pass.
Right.
And this is something that you cannot do with the optics denoiser.
And I think the optics denoiser also clamps it at one, is that correct?
Right now, yes. The guys at NVIDIA are working on this.
So
hopefully this will be solved. Be an issue at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, back when we did the initial experiments, that was a problem.
Right. Okay. Well, it's interesting to think of the denoiser, and especially in the context of, you know, seeing it interactive in some way. Obviously we covered several things that are happening. Is there any other things? I mean, we can make this podcast happen later so that we can talk about some of the other new things that are going to be upcoming
mm-hmm.
in V-Ray next. What are some of the other ones that you think you feel comfortable talking about?
So I mentioned GPU improvements. I mentioned the new kernel that we've been working on. But one of the big features that we wanted to have for V-Ray next is volumetric rendering on a GPU.
Right.
And that includes the environment fog, but also OpenVDB files and basically fluid simulations.
Fluid sim, smoke, water.
Smoke, fire,
yeah,
all this stuff. And it looks like GPUs are very good at this sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So it renders really fast.
Yeah.
And this is...
Why are they good at it? What makes them good at it?
Just because they are very good at processing... it's basically the same operation applied on a large amount of input data.
Okay.
And they're very good at this.
Right.
We had some of the code was in the first beta of Vue Next, but the second beta has the full implementation of the volumes.
And you can do VDBs as well, open VDBs, yep. Right? So if you did a fluid sim or a explosion of some kind in Houdini, you could bring it into yep. Max and render it on the GPU.
Yep.
And does it as how is the RAM usage for it on the GPU?
We try to save as much RAM as possible.
Okay.
So on the CPU, we can afford to keep everything at full floating point, all the buffers. On the GPU, we do stuff to reduce the memory usage.
Okay. And does it change it that much or not?
Nobody's noticed so far. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. So that's pretty exciting. And, you know, you did tease a little something on YouTube about a new frame buffer as well.
Yeah, so that's been going on for a while.
Yeah.
We knew that the current Vue frame buffer is basically not future-proof. It right. was done many, many years ago when we really didn't know that it will end up where it is today.
Right.
And at some point, people requested even more things like light mixer or being able to do more complex composing operations right inside the frame buffer. And it just wasn't made for this.
Yeah.
And we decided that our only option basically is to rewrite it from scratch. So we threw away all the code.
Yeah.
And we worked on a new version of frame buffer, which is entirely based on Qt.
Okay.
And this is what the teaser showed. Vladonedev is the developer who works on this. He also worked in V-Ray for Modo.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he work on one of the first versions of V-Ray for Maya? Like,
yeah, he
years
did a
and
lot
ago?
Of work in V-Ray for Maya back then.
Right.
But it's a big project because we want to make it so much more usable than what we have right now. So basically, it's just a mini compositor, or not even, it's a full-blown compositor right inside the frame buffer.
Right.
And it will take a while to do everything that we want, but we think that it's totally worth it, and it will be much more pleasant to use than what we have right now.
Yeah, I got to talk to Vlado today, the other Vlado, it's really interesting. He's got some really great ideas, and he's working on it to make it, you know, as many cool features as possible, but also trying to make it as intuitive as possible for mm-hmm. those to work, and things that are really clear. Like, for example, one of the things that I thought was cool about it is obviously there's a lot of comparing old renders. So now we've had the history for a while and we've had an A-B swipe, but he's added it so that now when you're in the A-B situation, it shows which side of the swipe is on what. So if you have one image, it'll show an A on the left side if your image is on the left side, and then a B on the right side.
Yeah. It's just little things like this.
I know, it's really cool. And then you can do quads now, which is even cooler. So it really makes a difference in terms of how you're looking at things.
Yep.
And so I think it was really, really cool what he's doing.
It will take a while. We probably won't be able to ship it with the initial release of Vue Next.
Right.
So it will come in a point update, but it's a huge amount of work.
Well, yeah, it's basically the main interface to Vue.
Yeah, that's what people see when they imagine when they think of Vue.
Right. Buffer. Yeah, so the frame buffer definitely, you know, I mean, I think it's the same thing as what you were saying earlier. It's like we just need a refresh. It's been hanging around for a long time.
You don't want to look at this code. It's
oh, the old frame buffer code?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how is it? What's it like? I mean, is this our first thing we've been doing in Qt or?
So no, we've been working with Qt for a long time.
Oh, right, because it's part of Maya, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. But the way the old frame buffer was done was basically we developed our own graphics library, and then which is sort of universal.
Right.
And then it could be compiled either with Qt or with WX widgets.
Right.
And we also had a third version that is just no user interface at all.
Okay.
just the functionality of the frame buffer.
Right.
And the fact that we had basically two code bases that did pretty much the same thing, but in different ways, was a huge restriction for the whole architecture of the frame buffer. And there was a lot. It also slowed things down because you had to convert stuff from our own interface to either WX or Qt, and the formats were not always the native ones.
Right.
So that was probably more CPU cycles than is optimal. And we did this originally because WX widgets is completely free. It's completely open source. And V-Ray then was a pretty small product. Qt, on the other hand, is more complicated. It's bigger. And the licensing is a little bit more complicated.
Okay.
But then all the main products that we developed for added Qt as the main user interface framework. Mm-hmm. So originally, neither Maya nor 3ds Max nor Modo, basically nobody used Qt when we started V-Ray. But then Maya switched to Qt. 3ds Max is now based on Qt. Modo also has a Qt version. Okay. All the Foundry products use Qt. So basically, it's
pretty straightforward.
Standard.
It's a standard, right?
And having the frame buffer written in the native UI framework allows us to do things like docking.
Okay.
And make it just more integrated into the application. So for VFB2, as we call it, the second version of frame buffer, it's basically written in Qt, native Qt, from the very beginning. So it's very snappy.
So you can dock it
faster. Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty cool. You can just put it right into a viewport then, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. What about high-res monitors? Because I know I've had an issue with those.
We pretty much solved this problem.
Okay.
There was a lot of work that Andre did. He's the guy who works on V-Ray for Blender and V-Ray for Houdini.
Yeah, I know Andre.
But he did a lot of work on the high DPI support for the V-Ray frame buffer.
Okay.
So that's been a solved problem for a while now.
Okay. So I don't know if we can, talk about it, but it will be coming out in the beta. I think we just discussed this, the cloud stuff. What about cloud stuff?
Yes. Now we can talk. Now that V-Ray for Rhino is actually released, we can talk about V-Ray cloud. So I guess that's probably not much of a surprise because we've been hinting about this for a while. Mm-hmm. At some point, we even had t-shirts that said V-Ray cloud.
Yeah.
But originally, we just did the software that could be used to implement a cloud service based on V-Ray. And we thought about our own cloud service, but back then, a few years ago, we weren't exactly ready for this.
Right.
And V-Ray wasn't ready for this.
Right.
But then we, then the Google Cloud happened, mm-hmm. and we realized that it's basically perfect for what we want to do with V-Ray Cloud.
Right.
And it's a project that's been going on under the radar for a long time,
uh-huh.
maybe 2 years, more than 2 years now. So it's not something that happened in a few months.
Yeah.
There were a lot of challenges to solve related around storing the assets and transferring assets to the cloud, making sure that everything is secure so that people can be not worry about their stuff.
Mm-hmm. Going places. We've had Boris on before. I mean, I think I remember, it was 2 years ago. Was it 2 years ago? It was 2 years ago where Boris talked about cloud and about securing cloud and how to make cloud secure. And it's all about your VM, right? Your VM has to be secure.
Yeah, and all the storage, all the assets should be done in a way that doesn't allow interference between different users.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to make sure that when you submit something for rendering in the cloud, you don't re-upload everything from scratch every single time.
Yep.
And a lot of research went into that. Basically textures, assets, but even the scene itself, we only transfer to the cloud what's actually needed for this render job. If something is on the cloud already, then we just don't transfer it.
So just to be clear, this is our own render service.
Yeah, it's basically a button that says render on the cloud.
Render on the cloud. Okay, in order for that to happen, obviously, you'd have to have an account with us. You'd have to have a credit card with us or something like that that would allow us to bill for the cloud mm-hmm. service or some other way that we implement it. We don't really have an idea. We haven't sort of made any announcements about pricing, so I'm not going to ask you that because I know we're still going through that process. But this is something that basically anyone, will automatically have a render farm based just by installing V-Ray into it, right?
Yeah.
And so, which is awesome. Obviously we're going to be doing it through Google Cloud, I'm assuming at this point, right? The Google Cloud is pretty fast.
Yeah, that's what we like about it. Yeah. It's not so Google has the cloud, but it also did the whole infrastructure around it, like making sure that you can get data to and from the cloud as quickly as possible.
And how do they do that?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know, but it's super fast. They have data centers all over the world.
Right. And that's another thing is wherever you are in the world, there's likely a Google data center not that far from you. Yeah. So that reduces your ping and then you can just go. Bloop.
We tried other cloud providers. We did a lot of experiments and this turned out to be the best.
Yeah, it turned out to be the best thing for you guys. And, well, that's great. So our users will benefit from that as well, which is good for them. So this will be coming out in the beta at some point as well, right?
Yeah, so the way that we do it right now, everything has to go through V-Ray standalone. So products that are based on V-Ray standalone, these are V-Ray for Rhino, V-Ray for SketchUp, V-Ray for Maya.
Right.
V-Ray for Revit as well. Basically anything but V-Ray for Max.
Right.
Max is always the odd one out because V-Ray is so, it started in Max and V-Ray is so tightly integrated with Max that it took us a long time to make sure that we can take a scene from Max and render it with V-Ray standalone on the cloud, which runs Linux and there's no Max. And you still have to make sure that stuff renders.
Right.
And
how are you doing this then?
So basically we take the whole scene in Max and we translate it to V-Ray specific components. Basically we have re-implemented many of the Max textures. Obviously we have the V-Ray materials and the V-Ray lights, but we also had to support plugins like Ornitrix, Forest Pro, other things that V-Ray can render in Max. We had to make sure if we can render with V-Ray standalone.
Yeah, and so if there's a dependence on another plugin, you don't need to install that other plugin.
So for plugins that we support right now, they are all taken care of. You don't need to install anything.
Okay.
Like you need to have the plugin on your local machine, obviously, because it doesn't work. Otherwise, you can't open the Max scene if you don't have it. But other than that, once it gets sent to the cloud, it works. And we do support most of the plugins that people normally use in their work. So it should be pretty usable.
Okay. So that's great. And then obviously people get billed in some way or whatever. And we can figure out the billing process or talk about that. I'll probably have to write a blog post about it.
Yeah, I mean, we do have a very good idea of what we want the pricing to look like. It's just let's wait for that part.
Release. Yeah. And what do you think is, obviously now if you have the entire Google render or system at your fingertips, that's going to change a lot of how way people work, don't you think?
It has changed things for me is what I know because, for example, I needed to do some experiments with... So I needed basically to render a large amount of images at different noise thresholds.
Okay.
There's just one small project that I'm doing at home where involving neural networks where I just needed those images. It's mm-hmm. not a denoiser. I just wanted to try stuff.
Right.
And we don't have a render farm in our office. I mean, we do have a small one, but it's for the 3D guys and they are using it. So I basically rendered all those images on V-Ray Cloud.
Right.
And it saved me like days of rendering on my machine.
Right.
So it was...
You just like, all right, here you go. Send. And then you had all the images back.
And the cool thing is that actually the submission to the V-Ray Cloud is scriptable. So there's just a command line tool that can upload a V-Ray scene file and then you can use it to download the results. So you can actually make a script around it. Obviously, there's a big render on the cloud button in Max, but if you also wanted to automate this, it's very easy.
Right. Okay. And then obviously when it's on the cloud, you'll be able to have interact with it through some kind of a web interface of some kind, right?
Yeah, it's all web based.
Of course it is, because it's Boris. So yeah. Everything can be web based.
We think that it's very easy to use. So hopefully people will like it.
Yeah. I'm excited about that. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what you think, and we don't, unfortunately, I have a 5 o'clock, so we'll probably have to cut the podcast short a little bit, but, you know, we've already talked about V-Ray Next, and then I want to talk about where you think generally V-Ray after Next is going to go, or where are some of the other ideas that you're thinking are going to be important to consider in the future.
There's so many things to try out, you know. Speed obviously is the thing that is always something that needs to be looked into. Mm-hmm. We have ideas for making V-Ray even faster. So I did an experiment like a while back. I compared V-Ray 1.5 with V-Ray 3.6, I think.
Okay.
For the same scene, and I tried to get similar results. And what happened is that V-Ray 3 was like 4 times faster and the result was cleaner with less noise. So it's actually amazing. And we can do even better than that. And we're looking into ways to make V-Ray faster. GPU rendering is something else that we are looking into. Obviously, CPUs are always there, but we see more and more people use GPUs for rendering. Mm-hmm. And originally, we thought that V-Ray GPU is going to be for more like previews or smaller scenes.
Well, the memory, you only had like a gig or 2 gigs.
Yeah, the GPUs back then when we started was a different story.
Right. Yeah, they're really small.
So we've started to revisit V-Ray GPU. We did this new kernel thing that I mentioned, but we're also looking into making it a lot more usable. We're looking into adding bucket rendering for it. For some reason, people associate like production rendering with buckets.
Right.
So we'll be doing buckets, not because of this perception, but because we feel that it's a better way to utilize GPUs.
Yeah, why is that?
Because with a progressive render, you basically spend a lot of time just updating the image at every iteration, and it's just wasted cycles.
Right.
Especially if you are rendering on a farm or in the cloud, you don't need to see these passes. So it makes sense that buckets are more efficient because you only display the bucket once it's completely done.
Right.
And so we're working on that. It's going to be in some version of V-Ray Next.
Okay.
We are also looking at, so NVLink gives us the ability to render larger scenes.
Yeah, it connects to cards.
But we're also looking at other ways to render large scenes on the GPU.
Okay.
And then there's also, so if you go CPUs, GPUs, and then the ultimate goal is real-time rendering.
Which real-time ray tracing.
Okay.
Or rendering. Okay.
But we see more and more people using real-time engines for production work in places, in situations that until recently required an offline render.
Right.
Non-real-time render. So this is something that's also worth exploring because ultimately the goal is to have real-time rendering, right, in some form.
Right.
And it's something that will be interesting to explore. And we can do different things about it, obviously. And we mentioned V-Ray for Unreal at some point. But this is just a stepping stone that for something else.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we've got some interesting partnerships with the Epic guys, and they've got some great ideas, and we've been working on our V-Ray for Unreal thing for a while. Yeah, obviously that was the announcement that happened at SIGGRAPH. But in general, I think it is going to become an important part of the experience that people have when they're mm-hmm. rendering.
Yep.
And so it's nice that we've been doing it for a while now in terms of how it's working. And so what I think is interesting about that specific thing is it's a little bit the Wild West. Like everyone kind of has a slightly different idea about what it is and what they can do.
That's why it's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's almost like whoever comes up with the cool solution, I mean, that's, or can suggest is like, oh, we'll do it this way. So that's going to be an interesting idea for sure. Do you think that real time is really going to change everything in some ways?
It's definitely a tool that people will use in more and more situations, especially as the workflows get sorted out.
It's not going to kill offline rendering, though.
No, you're still going to need this accurate ray traced render.
Right.
There isn't hardware today that can do real-time full GI ray tracing,
right.
No noise at 30 frames per second.
Right.
So you always need to go through some kind of either baking process or something else that prepares the scene for real-time if you want it to look realistic.
And if you really, even further than that, is going to be a full 8K VR experience at 90 frames a second.
Yeah.
So that's even more hard to solve.
Yeah, and so getting a real-time experience requires a lot of preparatory work, like baking all the lighting and making sure that everything fits on the GPU memory. Whereas with an offline render, you just have, for example, in Corona, you just have the render button and nice image comes out.
Yep.
All you need to worry is about setting up your scene, your lighting, your materials. You don't have to worry about
baking,
unwrapping, lighting, or baking or anything.
Shadow bias. Yeah.
So, and it's a different sort of freedom that I don't think people will just give up.
Yeah, and then everyone's like, "Oh, look, it's interactive," and I said, "Yeah, you know how much effort it took to make that interactive."
Yeah.
It does take a lot of effort, and effort on things that are not intuitive necessarily either.
Yeah, I'm sure things will improve. Workflows will be figured out. Things will get easier. But just being able to push a render button and get a nice image out will always be compelling in its own way.
Yeah. Well, cool. All right. Well, thanks so much, Vlado. I really appreciate you taking a little time on this. I'm going to go to another meeting. I've very busy time in Bulgaria right now for me, which is great because that means there's a lot going on.
Yeah, planning the next year. So.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on, but I really appreciate it, and I'm sure our listeners would love to know what your thoughts are. All right, thank you.
Thanks, Chris.